Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with Concord Coalition Policy Director Josh Gordon, Executive Director Bob Bixby, as well as economist Diane Lim, who will be joining us for our next Economist Mom segment. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The Trump administration reportedly plans to either bust statutory spending caps or sidestep them altogether in an effort to boost military spending but trim non-defense spending programs for the upcoming fiscal year. That could result in an overall discretionary spending increase in fiscal year 2020, even compared to this year. All this while criticizing Congress for irresponsible budgets and increases in red ink recently. The administration may try to sidestep caps by proposing the addition of as much as $174 billion to a war-related account that is exempt from spending limits, which would produce a total defense-related budget of roughly $750 billion without technically violating the spending caps. The amount of defense spending would be about $34 billion more than Congress appropriated this year and about $160 billion more than allowed under the fiscal year 2020 cap. The move was quickly branded as a budget gimmick to prop up defense spending through the back door. Under current law, non-defense discretionary spending will drop from $597 billion this year to about $542 billion next year, unless Congress raises the current spending caps in a new budget deal. There are unlikely to be any across-the-board cuts known as sequestration this year. That's according to the Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, which is required to issue a report each year on whether Congress violated the spending caps imposed under the 2011 deficit reduction law. The White House Office of Management and Budget gets the final word, but the CBO report is usually reliable. This year's spending caps were adjusted as part of a bipartisan budget deal, adding nearly $93 billion in additional spending, mostly for war-related costs and disaster relief. That brought the total defense limit this year to $716 billion and the total non-defense limit to $620.6 billion. That combined amount matches what was appropriated, so no sequestration will be required. As tax season continues, many Americans are complaining of shrinking tax refunds, when they were expecting even larger returns on the heels of the 2017 tax code overhaul. GOP lawmakers and their supporters are working to remind people that the tax cuts reduced almost everyone's taxes last year, regardless of what their tax refunds look like this year. That's because the cut came incrementally over the year in the form of more take-home pay. But Americans are accustomed to refunds, and IRS statistics show that they're about 17% lower on average so far. Democrats have jumped at the opportunity to ramp up criticism of the tax code overhaul. The Treasury Department has emphasized that the numbers are early, coming just a few weeks after filing officially started January 28th. The Brookings Institution issued a report this month that provided new estimates on the federal budget outlook. In its opening remarks of the publication, Brookings acknowledged the CBO's latest long-term outlook, which projected a debt-to-GDP ratio of 93% by fiscal year 2029 under current law, which was up from 78% today. But Brookings went a step further in its analysis of current policy as opposed to current law, reflecting the fact that policymakers routinely extend temporary provisions like tax breaks. As a result, Brookings projects a debt-to-GDP ratio above 106% by 2029, which would be the highest ratio in U.S. history and the highest since the World War II era. Those projections include the only sustained period during which the U.S. has had full employment and deficits around and above 4% of GDP. The numbers only increase or get worse from there. Brookings also noted that ensuring the debt-to-GDP ratio 30 years from now does not exceed the current level would require a combination of immediate and permanent spending cuts and/or tax increases totaling 3.9% of GDP, which would be a 21% cut in non-interest spending or a 24% increase in tax revenues. You can find and read the whole report at brookings.edu. Up next, Concord Coalition Policy Director Josh Gordon will join me to discuss recent growth in healthcare spending. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Policy Director Josh Gordon. Josh is a familiar voice on Facing the Future, having shared his expertise on a wide variety of topics. He directs Concord's research on the federal budget, healthcare policy, and tax policy. He has a PhD from the University of Florida and has been with Concord since 2001. Welcome back, Josh.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Wanted to have you on the show today, Josh, to talk about some new projections in terms of healthcare cost growth. There was a recent report that came out that you've done some writing on. So maybe to kick off this segment, you can share a little bit about that report, maybe who wrote it, and a high-level summary of its findings.
Every year, the Medicare actuaries release their projections for healthcare spending for the next 10 years. And they also release their kind of retroactive look on healthcare spending. That happened in December. So I like to look at these two reports together every year and kind of get a picture for where healthcare spending is going, because as you and I'm sure your listeners know, healthcare cost growth is the most important factor leading to long-term federal budget unsustainability. So we like to look at trends not just for government healthcare programs, but for healthcare spending overall to kind of figure out where we're headed and what we need to do to change where we're headed to help the federal budget over the long term.
And so what were some of those findings in looking ahead? I believe they gave some projections of what the next decade or so might look like or what might be driving healthcare cost growth. Can you give us a little insight there as well?
Yeah, I think the big picture is that, as they say, really every year over the next decade and over the long term, healthcare will be growing faster than the economy. And when that happens, healthcare as a sector and what we all consume in the healthcare world and healthcare services, all of those things are growing to be a larger and larger share of our entire economy. And this is ultimately a problem because if we continued on these trends, you would go from having a sixth of the economy devoted to healthcare to about a fifth in a decade. And then it just keeps growing and growing in the future, and we can't really have an economy that is so heavily weighted towards just one sector. So I think that's kind of our overall concern. And then when you look at the federal budget, you see that our healthcare programs with the federal budget grow along with healthcare costs and will grow to consume a larger and larger share of the federal budget. And that's what the Concord Coalition worries about the most. And in this report specifically, you see that Medicare itself as a program is growing faster than any other areas in the healthcare sector. And that really is mainly because Medicare beneficiaries will be growing and getting older. We're just going to have more and more people on the program, and that provides an increase for healthcare spending in general, even if healthcare costs in the government programs grow more slowly than the private sector. And I think that's the real kind of interesting interplay that you see in this report, that the healthcare programs of the federal budget don't grow more fast than the private sector, just in terms of per enrollee or per capita cost. But what's happening is you have, as the population ages, more and more people shifting where they get their health care from health insurance provided by employers and in the private market to, as they retire, government programs. And that shift drives federal budget issues and is also kind of driving this change in where we're spending our healthcare dollar.
So, Josh, you also mentioned earlier on that the healthcare cost growth is growing faster than economic growth. Do you know by about how much it's growing faster than the economy?
Well, these projections are for healthcare costs to grow just under 1% of GDP faster than the economy. So every year the economy grows, healthcare grows by the same amount plus under 1%, like 0.8% in this report. And that's actually a pretty decent shift from when I started looking at healthcare costs 2 decades ago. Healthcare costs were projected to grow faster than GDP by about 2 to 2.5%. So in the last decade or so, we've actually had slower growth of healthcare costs than we had if you go back in average the last 3 to 4 decades of time. So in some ways, we're making some progress in having slower cost growth in healthcare. But even if we keep healthcare cost growth to just 1% faster than the economy, it still winds up taking a larger share of the economy and, of course, putting pressure on the federal budget, especially when you combine those healthcare inflation numbers with what we get by sheer increasing enrollment in government programs.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord's Policy Director, Josh Gordon. We're discussing a recent report that discusses the projected cost growth in healthcare. And Josh, you mentioned a couple things I wanted to follow up on there. You mentioned the over the last couple decades, we have seen a slowdown in that healthcare cost growth. And I vaguely remember even seeing reports or coverage of how healthcare cost growth had stabilized in 2017. I guess my question would be, is this projection a blip? Have we reached a point where we can stabilize healthcare cost growth? If not, can you shed some light on why we've seen a slowdown?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about this report, and these tend to not be very interesting because they happen on an annual basis, but this one stands out because the actuaries specifically say that over the last decade, healthcare costs have been impacted pretty dramatically by legislative changes, which is, I think, kind of unusual. We had the Affordable Care Act, we had the expansion of Medicaid, and then there were also some unique changes in insurance markets where high deductible health insurance became much more popular over the last decade or two, meaning people saw healthcare costs in their actual everyday life more than they had in the past because they were responsible for more of their costs. And also in the prescription drug market, there were some really temporary blips where you had a lot of drugs coming off patent at one point, and then you had these hepatitis C drugs coming on market. And so over the last decade, we've had, I think, more fluctuation in healthcare costs than they're projecting for the future. And I think that's the interesting thing. Here they're saying over the next decade, they expect us to have our healthcare costs and healthcare spending affected by much more traditional levers like income growth and the aging of the population, as opposed to what we've seen in the last decade where there was a slowdown, as you mentioned, and also some increases because of the Affordable Care Act, the expansion of Medicaid, and those other factors. So we have this temporary blip over the last decade where things really changed pretty dramatically, and then over the next decade they're not allowed to project policy changes, so they're projecting what would happen if we kind of stayed at the status quo over the next decade, where aging and income are much more important in healthcare trends than some of the changes we saw in the past.
So, Josh, if this is driven largely by demographic shifts moving forward, you discussed the last decade or so and how policy has had an impact, but looking forward, it's largely a generational demographic issue that's driving this cost growth. Is it a matter of endurance? Is this sort of a generational shift that amounts to swallowing a bubble and then, maybe cost growth comes down on the back end? Or is this a long-term issue that is irrespective of what generation is currently in the healthcare system?
Yeah, I think for the most part, once you have this aging of the population, and actually I think the most interesting fact I saw in this report was that the actuaries expect 2019 to to represent the peak year of enrollment growth in Medicare as the baby boom generation ages. That aging influences healthcare spending in two ways. One, you have this change where the aged population is now on government programs, so they're changing the government spending mix, really. But also, as people get older, they spend more on healthcare. And so you have these two combined effects on the budget going forward from this aging of the population. And the aging of the population is really a permanent shift. It isn't a bubble. It is that once the baby boom generation is on Medicare, it's not like Medicare beneficiaries will then shrink. It's that they're the first part of this wave where you just have a permanently older population with less people in the workforce working and paying taxes to support the larger group than we've seen historically receive benefits for health care from Medicare, Medicaid to some degree going forward.
All right, last question before we have to go here, Josh. And we're in the 2020 primary. I'm up here in New Hampshire, so I don't think I can let you go without asking, how would you hope to hear candidates running for president? How would you like to hear them talk about this issue? What kind of solutions would you hope to see coming in terms of their platforms and plans?
I think the main thing I want to see is, and maybe I'm hoping for too much, but I want a smart discussion on healthcare spending that recognizes the difference between increasing spending because people are transferring from the private sector to the public sector. I think that's one issue. So you can see that some people will say we have a federal budget crisis because Medicare spending is growing faster than any part of the budget, and we need to do something about how fast Medicare spending is growing. But what I would like is for that to be unpacked. There is a part of Medicare spending that is growing because simply more people are becoming eligible for the program. So that has a different solution or a different way of attack than attacking healthcare inflation itself, where healthcare costs grow faster than the economy. Those are two distinct problems, and they have, I think, in large part, distinct solutions. So any time you hear people talking about health insurance, I want to know if they're getting healthcare costs themselves to grow slower and to keep pace with the economy, or are they just shifting how people are getting their insurance, where they're getting their insurance from, and even in some cases, maybe they aren't getting insurance and you're saving money that way. So that's the distinction I want to hear a smarter discussion about on both from Republicans and Democrats in the campaign season.
Then I guess it falls on us smart voters, Josh, to ask for that multi-layered discussion, which is often hard to have in campaigns, but I'd like to see that as well. This is Facing the Future. I've been talking to Concord's Policy Director, Josh Gordon. We discussed some projected cost growth in the healthcare system. Thanks for joining the show once again, Josh.
Always my pleasure to be here, Chase.
Up next, economist Diane Lim will join me and Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, for the next edition of our Economist Mom segment. We'll be talking about the debt limit, taxes, and some Medicare for all. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by economist Diane Lim and Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby. Diane is a principal at the District Economics Group and is joining us for our recurring segment, The Economist Mom. Diane and Bob are regular contributors on the show. Welcome back.
Thanks, Chase.
Good to be back.
Good to be here.
We're going to have a whole variety of topics today, I think. I'd like to touch on the debt limit, some tax-related issues, maybe even get to Medicare for All if we have enough time. But let's kick it off with the debt limit. It's becoming more of a talking point in Washington, at least right now, as we near the next deadline to either suspend it or increase it. Maybe give us a quick rundown from both of you on what it is, what it does, and whether raising it is a good or bad thing.
Well, the debt limit is sort of a statutory, a legal construct that has kind of very little economic meaning, in the sense that what determines how much debt the government's running is the spending that it's obligated to do, and that the government's promised relative to revenues. And so when we keep spending beyond revenues, we add to the deficit, or we create a deficit, and the deficit adds to the accumulated debt. So debt is the stock of past deficits. And the debt limit was really designed as sort of a way to make Congress kind of confess to its sins, maybe, admit that it had failed to keep the debt in check and that it had surpassed a kind of arbitrary limit that had been previously set, an arbitrary limit in terms of economic meaning for the debt. And so it's been treated as an action-forcing event that, you know, you kind of shame Congress into saying, oh, we didn't do well, we have to raise the debt ceiling again. But it's become a problem politically because it's really been used quite as, instead of a discipline tool, it's been used as a weapon. So it's kind of a shame because it really does jeopardize the functioning of the government and it's the government's responsibilities. And so I don't like the debt limit. I've never liked the debt limit. I understand the initial kind of purpose of it, but it doesn't really impose the discipline that one would hope. And instead, it just encourages, the political partisan antics that prevents us from making progress on anything.
Yeah, I look at it as a trigger that can't be pulled. I mean, because unlike a government shutdown, which is bad enough and should not happen, if they go to the debt limit and don't raise it or play games with it, then you're putting the nation's credit worthiness at risk. And it's for no reason, because it's not like the U.S. can't pay its bills. It's that the U.S. is refusing to pay its bills.
Yeah.
So I've never thought as a fiscal conservative or one who worries about the deficit and the debt, what is fiscally responsible about refusing to pay your bills? Because once you're at the debt limit, you've already incurred the obligation. It's just a question of whether or not you'll pay it. So I'd be in favor of some sort of, I don't want to necessarily say debt limit, but some sort of targeted debt to GDP ratio or something like that that had a more economically meaningful target. The current debt limit is just simply a dollar figure that's pulled out of the air. It doesn't have any economic meaning. And yet, if we were to fail to raise the debt limit in time and the government had to start defaulting on some of its obligations, picking and choosing which bills it would pay, that could have damaging effects on the nation's creditworthiness. So would end up having to pay higher interest rates because people would say, well, you know, if we're going to lend to the U.S., you never know if you're going to get your money on time, which is a really ridiculous position for a nation as wealthy as ours to put itself in. So I think there's some real problems with the current debt limit mechanism.
Yeah, I mean, ironically, it's worse for our economy to not pass the debt limit increase than to just let the debt keep growing. I mean, if we force the debt limit and therefore default on the debt that will keep growing,
that's worse than growing the debt.
Worse than growing the debt. So it's an artificial constraint that does more harm than good.
By the way, can I just give you a little historical aside? And I wasn't there for this, Chase, but the debt limit came about, ironically, during the World War I period as a way to facilitate government borrowing, because they had to borrow a lot of money for World War I, and so they had to keep going to Congress, and Congress said, well, why don't we just give you a certain sum of money authorization for the Treasury to borrow? So they set a debt limit, but they weren't thinking of setting a ceiling. They were basically
trying
to give, you know, that you don't have to keep coming back to us up
we'll
until
this
point.
We'll just open up a line for you.
Right. So, Bob, you mentioned that you weren't there. Would it be uncouth of me to say you might have to prove that?
Well, I was wasn't there, but I had my grandfather's World War One helmet. So
that's awesome.
Very cool, yeah.
That's very cool. What's not very cool is the fact that the debt limit hasn't done a very good job of shaming policymakers into having some more responsible long-term policy. But one question I did have, sort of about the mechanics of how all this works. I've heard the term extraordinary measures thrown around quite a bit in terms of when the actual debt limit expires or is exceeded, or some change needs to be made to either increase it or suspend it. So what are extraordinary measures? How do they work?
Well, they're extraordinary. What it basically is just the Treasury Secretary has the authority to start shifting money around.
Yeah.
In various government accounts, and the law allows them to do that, and that keeps the limit from going up. It allows the Treasury to borrow from the public money that it wouldn't be able to otherwise.
It is just moving money.
Yeah, it's just moving money. So nobody's harmed by it. It's just an accounting gimmick. But you can only do it for so long. After a while, the borrowing needs of the government exceed the level, amount to which the Treasury Secretary can do this sort of shifting around of accounts.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and economist Diane Lim in our recurring Economist Mom segment. We've been talking about the debt limit, how it works, what the next few months might look like. I wanted to shift gears, sort of like the money that'll be shifted around in extraordinary measures to extend that debt limit a little further, and talk about taxes and tax refunds. It is currently tax filing season. I've seen in the news some complaints about lower than expected tax refunds on the heels of the 2017 tax code overhaul. And then we've got the New Hampshire primary, the 2020 presidential election cycle going on. And a lot of candidates are talking about increasing taxes on higher income or higher wage earners. So let's start with the tax refund issue. You know, why do you think those complaints are occurring, and why are we seeing actually lower than prior years tax refunds?
Well, anytime, you know, we just had this big tax change at the end of 2017, effective for calendar year, tax year 2018. So this is the first tax filing season that people have been, filing their tax returns under the new tax law. Now, anytime there's a big change in the tax system and tax law, the IRS has to try to figure out how this is going to affect different types of taxpayers, and they have to adjust those withholding tables that employees fill out to arrange for, you know, certain amounts of taxes to be withheld from each of their paychecks. So it's difficult for, the IRS isn't going around and calculating each person's tax liability based on the details of the previous year's tax return that was filed. So they're generalized, they're average kind of guesses, assuming that you're the average taxpayer with the average set of itemized deductions. This effect of not getting the refunds right, or having certainly a change in refunds for better or worse compared to the prior years, is not surprising, given that once you get through 1 year of tax returns under the new tax law, you will, as a taxpayer, you'll be more prepared for this tax year, 2019, to adjust your withholding in anticipation of what your ultimate tax bill will be. Now, lots of people confuse the refund that you get at the end of the tax filing season with the taxes you've actually paid throughout the year, because a lot of people don't really pay attention to the taxes that are withheld during the year, and they don't really think of it somehow as taxes they paid compared to taxes that you have to pay in excess of what you've already withheld, which feels like the taxes, the total taxes you're paying.
Yeah, think about it this way. It's an entirely human reaction. If you see a slight increase in your paycheck, you don't really question it. It's just, oh, that's nice, you know. But then it comes around the end of the year, and if you've actually been getting that refund in advance, is what's happening, because you're having less withholding. And, you know, you don't get a $4,000 or $5,000 check. You get a much lower check, and for a refund, and it's like, oh my goodness, this is, I'm getting ripped off here. So,
right.
Yeah, so people, I mean, some people are paying more just because they have fewer deductions than they might have been if they lived in states where you could have deducted and local taxes that you can't anymore deduct. So, I mean, that's not to say that there aren't people that are ending up with bigger tax bills, but I think a lot of it is people just reacting to the fact that they're getting a lower refund, but they might have in effect already gotten that refund in advance.
It sounds like maybe there was some lacking in the marketing budget for how that 2017 tax cut might impact everyone. I'm curious, you mentioned, Diane, that we sort of go through these labor pains when experiencing a tax code overhaul, and we just touched on how people are getting upset that, you know, they haven't been paying attention to their paychecks, but at the end of the year, the refund is different than they had expected. When something like this happens, and, you know, everyone's world is rocked a little bit, is there a trend afterwards to pay a little more attention to budget policy?
Maybe. You know, there is sort of this personal effect if you're working on your taxes and you're surprised on your refund or the amount you owed. You know, I think people are going to pay a little bit more attention to this year's tax returns they file and their experience, because they'll probably want to adjust their withholding or be, you know, just more prepared for what their true tax liability is likely to be for tax year 2018 when they file, tax year 2019 when they file in 2020. So I think it always helps to have a more personal interaction with government policy, to pay a little bit more attention to it. Just like, you know, when there was lots of threats to end Obamacare, suddenly people had incentive to, like, figure out, oh, do I get Obamacare? You know, what would this mean for me? And I think until you can find the answer to what does this mean for me, people don't pay attention to the details. And it's true that we haven't had sort of, this was a bigger tax change in terms of not just lowering tax rates, that there were changes to major itemized deductions and, changing from a personal exemption system to a standard deduction. So it did affect different types of families differently, and a little bit more kind of, I wouldn't call it fundamental tax reform, but it was closer to a bigger overhaul of the definition of taxable income than, for example, the Bush tax cuts were. So, yeah, I think people will pay more attention to tax policy.
So that sort of, you talked about the personal impact of taxes. One change in the tax code that probably wouldn't personally impact me is all this talk on the campaign trail of seeing a dramatic increase in those tax rates for those who are incredibly wealthy. I'm not incredibly wealthy, so why should I care if we decide as a Congress or a country to spike those tax rates?
Before Diane answers that question, let me say that I can personally vouch for the fact that Chase is not independently wealthy because I pay his salary.
So, you know, I think that we were just talking about the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and that was a large tax cut in terms of revenue costs. And the tax cut disproportionately benefited higher income households because of the rate reductions. And higher income households naturally, or I should say historically, have paid higher tax rates on their income, both in terms of what we call marginal tax rates, which is the tax rate you pay on your last dollars earned, and in terms of average tax rates, which is your total taxes paid divided by your total income. And so that's what we call a progressive tax system. We've had almost pretty much for the whole history of the income tax, even when it only affected very wealthy people, we've always had this notion that the income tax system is progressive. It takes a relatively larger fraction of income from higher income households. Well, Tax Cuts and Jobs Act reduced the progressivity of the tax system. It is still a progressive income tax. On average, higher income households pay larger percentages of their income in taxes. But there are a lot of policymakers and experts who think, we are not raising enough revenue, and B, high income households have done exceptionally well over the past couple decades in terms of income growth and in terms of benefiting from tax cuts. and see that raising tax rates back up, even though we just cut them, raising tax rates on highest income households very likely doesn't have a big effect on economic incentives. Like high income households are not going to have an incentive to reduce their income in order to avoid paying taxes. They might have the incentive to shift their income into lower tax forms of income, but they're not going to stop earning a lot of income just because the marginal tax rate goes up. So the debate is over, is between, you know, liberals who would like to see tax burdens on the rich go up and for the rich to pay more of their fair share, and to just raise more revenue for the rest of government spending and also to reduce the deficit, and the conservatives who will make kind of traditional supply-side arguments against raising taxes on the rich, which the traditional economic supply-side argument is that that will hurt the entire economy. If you raise taxes on the rich, they will be less productive, they'll earn less income, and their income helps the whole economy. There's less investment, less saving, and that hurts the whole economy, and it actually affects, you know, wages, wage levels of all workers, even the middle class and lower income workers who aren't paying higher taxes. So that those are sort of back to the same old debate. We've had this debate since the 1980s, honestly, and it's always a debate between how much of an incentive effect do higher marginal tax rates have on high income households. And, you know, liberals will say not much, and conservatives will say a lot. And, you know,
doesn't it have to, I mean, there's like a crossover point somewhere on what the rate would be that would actually have an effect. So, I mean, if the top rate is, what is it now?
You're talking about Laffer-Cook?
Yeah, isn't it like 37% now or something?
Right.
That's the top rate. So, I mean, there wouldn't, if you raise it to like 45%, it would have a different effect, presumably, than if you raised it to 70%.
Exactly, yes. So we are not, historically, our marginal tax rates, even at the top end of the income distribution, are pretty darn low compared to where they have been in the past. And in the past, when we had much, much higher marginal tax rates, economists studied back then, where's the revenue maximizing tax rate? And they would come up with a rate around, you know, maybe between 70 and 80% marginal tax rate. That's the revenue maximizing tax rate back then. That doesn't mean that it would be under current economic conditions. I don't know what the revenue maximizing tax rate is. But that revenue maximizing tax rate basically means if you go beyond that, if you went to like 80%, 85% marginal tax rates, such that a high-income person on their next dollar earned, if it under an 85% marginal tax rate, they only get to keep 15 cents of that dollar that they earn. And if it's past the revenue maximizing point, that means they're going to reduce their labor supply. They're going to, you know, reduce their working hours. They're going to reduce their saving in order to avoid that
shift,
really high tax rate.
Yeah, shift income. That's the other thing.
And they'll shift income.
It's like, you know, punching a pillow or something.
And we've talked about how, and unfortunately we're going to have to go soon, so I think we're going to save Medicare for All for a future program. But before we leave this, one question I had. Diane, you mentioned that economists studied that a most effective top rate would be between 70 and 80% back in the 80s or 90s. And we saw some rates as high as that or a little bit higher. My question is, at those times, were income earners at that level actually paying that amount? What was their effective rate? Was it much lower because they were shifting money around?
Right. Exactly. I don't want to, you know, the revenue maximizing tax rate is not the best tax rate. First of all, I want to clarify that. And it's a marginal tax rate. And so it's the tax rate beyond which you don't, raising it further will not get you any more revenue. It'll get you less revenue. That's the idea. Now, we have not, you know, that's a marginal tax rate. A high income household who might face a top rate, you know, of 35%, say, a high income household where each next dollar earned faces a marginal tax rate of 35% would mean that they keep 65% of their income after taxes. That does not mean that that's their average tax rate, because we have all these lower marginal tax rates at lower levels of income. And a point that a lot of people are confused about, and that includes people talking about the recent, you know, the AOC proposal for a 70% top marginal tax rate. You have to realize that 70% is only in the last dollars earned, the highest income portion of a high-income person's total income. So all the to get to a high marginal tax rate like that, you first walk through all the bottom brackets of tax rates that people face. So if you, all you're doing is raising a top marginal tax rate, it turns out you do very little to the average tax rate for most people. You can't do anything to an average tax rate unless someone actually is a high enough income that you're going into those top brackets that are being increased. So average tax rates are always much lower, what economists call effective tax rates, which is like a measure of the tax burden.
Well, that's certainly good clarity on the topic. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and Diane Lim. During our latest Economist Mom segment, we discussed the debt limit and taxes, but didn't quite get to Medicare for All. We'll save that for a future show. Thank you for joining the show once again, Diane and Bob. We'll be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So, it's time to face this fact. The debt limit is more trouble than it's worth. The debt limit has existed for more than 100 years, but it has increasingly become a political weapon to hold up legislation, drive a wedge between parties, or play a dangerous game of chicken with the nation's creditworthiness. The original purpose of creating a statutory debt limit back in 1917 was not to prevent the government from running up too much debt, but to remove the requirement that Congress would have to authorize individual issuances of debt. The intent was to help ensure that sufficient and timely credit would be available to finance World War I. And it's been a while since it's been in the news. Congress suspended the debt limit more than a year ago. The deadline to either increase it or suspend it once more will make its return this week, but the Treasury has said it could use what are called extraordinary measures to extend it a little bit longer. Frankly, Congress ought to approve an increase or another suspension of the debt limit this time around as well. Better to do it sooner rather than later to take what has become a political bargaining chip off the table. Why? The debt limit does not actually constrain the growth of our national debt, which now totals more than $22 trillion. And failing to raise the limit would cause a default on at least part of our debt, would do more damage to our economy than good, and make it harder to acquire new debt, which would be bad at a time when we have budget deficits that are fast approaching $1 trillion a year. Twice since 2010, the nation was driven to the brink as policymakers debated over conditions for a debt limit increase in order to avoid partial default on government obligations. Financial markets, government creditors, and the public looked on with increasing horror and frustration. And there's no guarantee that similar brinksmanship on the debt limit will not be used in the future. Given the current political climate, we may even see a third push to the brink, perhaps even a default. If we want to move beyond crisis management and back to rational budgeting, we should recognize that the debt limit has itself become part of the problem. It begins with a basic misunderstanding of what the debt limit does. Many people naturally assume that a debt limit exerts control over the nation's fiscal policies. It doesn't. Unlike budget process mechanisms such as caps or appropriations or pay-as-you-go rules that require spending increases or tax cuts to be paid for, the debt limit places no restrictions on specific tax and spending decisions. All it does is prevent the government from issuing debt to pay the bills that it has already run up. It's like trying to curb your personal spending by tossing your unpaid credit card bills in the trash. And the specific debt limit amount lacks any direct ties to the state of the economy or spending and tax decisions. Politicians simply pick a number and then fight about it, turning the congressional budget process into a series of short-sighted, makeshift deals cobbled together at the last minute. The pointlessness of this exercise is demonstrated by the fact that neither political party has proposed a budget plan that would avoid further increases in the current limit. And there's a cost to this bad habit. Studies have found that even getting close to the debt limit can cause enough uncertainty in the market for Treasury securities that borrowing costs increase. As a matter of sound fiscal policy, there's no good reason to have a hard dollar cap on the debt. Washington's goal should be to first stabilize the debt and then bring it down to a sustainable level relative to the economy. Even if the debt continues to grow, it will become less of a threat if it grows more slowly than the economy. Some argue that the debt limit provides useful leverage to extract fiscal reforms that would be hard to enact otherwise. But it's a trigger that should never be pulled, and thus has limited value. Why even risk a misfire? Refusing to pay the nation's bills would damage the nation's creditworthiness and economy while doing nothing to address the underlying mismatch between federal spending and revenues that is producing higher debt. If politicians want to reform the debt limit so that it might do some good, they could come up with a way to tie the nation's debt to an economically relevant standard, such as the growth rate of the economy. They could also align debt limit increases with the policy decisions that require more borrowing, ensuring that additional debt incurred under a budget resolution is approved alongside it. Now that the debt limit has simply become an opportunity to provoke a crisis, it would be best to scrap the current system. The real solution to unsustainable debt is not to risk default, but to enact more fiscally responsible policies in the first place. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.